To the Takedown. I'm your host, Nick Greiner, and today with me, I'm very excited. This man has, we've been Twitter pals for a little while, and I think that, in my opinion, probably in the fitness industry, one of the top guys to follow is Jerry Texera. How are you, sir?
Doing pretty good, Nick. How about you, man?
I'm well, man. Welcome to the show. I appreciate you being here. So, Jerry, I tell you what, there's obviously a lot of things. I've been following you for a long time on Twitter, and I love your content. I tell people to go to your YouTube page. People that are on Twitter, I tell them to follow you because I think you're a fantastic resource. And what I would like to start with is kind of maybe if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit of your story, kind of how you got to where you were. And even with like, you know, your YouTube channel is kind of blown up, man. I saw that. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's starting to get there.
That's good. That's awesome. And it should be, man, because that's amazing information, especially now if gyms are closed and things like that, people need to train. So, could you share a little insight with us?
Yeah. So, growing up, I was never an athlete. I played a lot of video games. And so I grew up, partially part of my life I spent on a dairy, and we were like, you know, 30 miles from the nearest real city. And so there was just nothing to do out there. And so I was kind of like, I guess there's like a, you know, a duality where, so I did physical work on a dairy and stuff like that. But then I played a bunch of video games, read a lot of books in my downtime. And my grandmother raised me from like eighth grade on pretty much. And so there wasn't like the male role model that really wanted me to get into sports or anything like that. So my first real experience with anything intense physically was when I was a senior in high school. I decided I was going to join the military. And when I made this decision, it was a lot really out of character, because again, I had no physical training, no background in anything like that, you know. And I won't spend too much time on that, but the way it came around is my grandmother raised her kids, and she kind of spoiled the boys and bailed them out every time they got in trouble and that type of deal. So what happened is my dad and his brothers, they ended up not being the most responsible, you know? And so my grandfather passed at this point. I think she realized the mistake she made. So when she had me in her home for those years, she told me when I was in like eighth grade, she said, "Hey, look, when you turn 16, you're gonna want a car. So I've got you working on the dairy. So you're gonna save your money. And what I'll do for you is when you turn 16, I'll match however much money you have saved, I'm going to match it, and you can put it toward, you know, a truck or whatever." And my grandmother was pretty well off, and she was, you know, poor. These are Portuguese immigrants, my grandparents, and they started dirt poor with nothing, and they did just work really hard over, you know, decades, and they ended up becoming successful. So, you know, the American dream and all that. But being young, and I just figured, well, she's not going to let me not have a car, you know. Right. So I didn't save very much money. I think I had a couple hundred, like $700 or something by the time I turned 16. And so then she's like, "Well, now you've got $1,400. So, and I'm like, "Well, what am I going to buy for $1,400? And she's like, "Well, I don't know. That's your problem to figure out, you know?" So I ended up not getting a car till I became an adult and bought one myself. You know, I kind of squandered that. And she told me the same thing as far as going to college, because I wasn't her only grandkid. She had 19 of them.
Wow.
And she always believed like she can't favor one and not the other. But she was also kind of like raising me, you know, primarily. So she told me with college, she's like, "Hey, look, if you get scholarship somewhere, then I'll help you by matching that and you can go to school. But if not," and I don't know why, but I just kind of blew it off. And so I got accepted to different schools based on SAT scores and stuff like that. But my grades were like 3.0. So she's like, "Oh, well, what scholarships did you get?" And I was like, "No, I didn't really get any scholarship offers." She's like, "Well, I don't know. You better figure out how you're going to go to school then." She stood by her guns and didn't bail me out like she did my dad and her, you know, his brother and all that. So I wasn't mad at her. Like, I realized that it was my fault. You know what I mean? She gave me the rules and I didn't uphold my end of the bargain, basically. So what I did is she let me drive her car. I had my license and all that at that point. I just didn't have my own car. So I drove to town and I went to the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. And I had already like, "Oh, Marines are crazy. I'm not going to the Marine Corps," you know? And so I talked to the three recruiters to ask, "Hey, what can the Army offer me? What can the Air Force offer me?" And then when I walked in the Marine recruiter, I stuck my head in. I was like curious once I got there, you know, because all the recruiting offices are right next to each other. So I stuck my head in, and unlike the other branches, there was, you know, all the guys were, none of them were fat, none of them were unhealthy, nothing like that. They all looked good. But when I popped my head in the Marine office, the guy sitting at the front desk, Staff Sergeant Mendoza, and they called him Dozer. And the dude looked like a bulldozer. He was an absolute unit. I mean, dude, he was jacked. I mean, like when I saw the guy, I was like, oh my God, that guy's a machine, you know?
Yeah.
And he was a recon Marine and a sniper and a spec ops guy. So he had this, you know, 50 cal sniper rifle up on the wall and all this cool stuff. And it was just like completely different than the other offices I went into. And so I was like, so then I asked him, he's like, hey, what can I do for you? And I said, well, I'm looked at the other branches. And so I want to know what the Marine Corps can do for me. And he's like, well, that's not the right question. And this isn't the right office. He's like, what can you do for the Marine Corps? You know, and he like threw it at me like that. And I mean, the guy was masterful at his job, obviously, looking back, right. Like great salesman, you know.
Right.
But he ended up recruiting me. I told him, yeah, this is what I want to do. We sat and talked for a couple hours and I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. And then I went back and I told my grandmother that I'd made up my mind. This is what I was going to do. And it was completely out of nowhere. And she was super against it just cause she's worried, you know, right, I mean, right. She's always supported the military and stuff, but she was like, what if something happens to you? So the next day she goes, hey, listen, go to school. I'll make sure you can go to school. I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it. Go to college. And I was like, no, you told me the rules. I didn't do what I was supposed to do. So I made up my mind. I'm going to take care of myself. You don't need to take care of me anymore. So then I went into the Marine Corps the day after I turned 18 and just took care of myself from that point on, you know?
Yeah.
But that was my first, the reason I mentioned all that was my first exposure to physical training was, I mean, I kind of ran and did push-ups and pull-ups and stuff to get ready for boot camp, but that was pretty much it. That military experience was my first physical training experience. And it was also my first experience with calisthenics. You know, it's body weight stuff, push-ups, pull-ups. And when you get into the military, you do a ton of that stuff. You're not really heavy lifting, although recently they've been changing some of the training a little more, you know, incorporating deadlifting and some things like that. So it is improving. But my first exposure to body weight training was not body weight strength training. Right. It was just basic calisthenics, you know, which most people, when they think of body weight training, that's what they think. Your jumping jacks, push-ups, and all that kind of stuff. And so I got lean and mean, like they say. You build up really good endurance, but you're not putting on size, you know. So I went through boot camp and all my training and made it through my first year out in the Marine Corps post all my training. And I never went to a gym or lifted. It was just your basic morning PT, going on runs, push-ups, that kind of stuff. And I was like 155, 160 pounds lean. And then they moved me and stationed me in the middle of the desert, like absolute middle of nowhere. And there was my barracks was across the street from the gym. So coming home from work one day, I kind of looked at the gym and then I thought, you know, maybe I'll go check out the gym because there's just nothing else to do, right? And so I walked in the gym and the first time I walked in, it looked like medieval torture devices. I had no idea what any of it was, you know? I mean, I wasn't an idiot. I know what a dumbbell is or a barbell, but I had no clue what I was doing. And so I walked back out and I went to the library on base there and I either checked out or bought, I can't remember at this point, but I got Arnold Schwarzenegger's Guide to Modern Bodybuilding because I had no clue what I was doing. And I read it front to back over like, you know, 4 or 5 days or whatever. And then I copied out some of the workout stuff from there. And then I went back to the gym with a plan. I was not like I was an expert at this point. I was still super noob, but I got okay results because I actually went in with a plan, you know? Right. And I've always been the kind of person where I'll tackle anything, you know, just about anything. But I'm not just going to tackle it having no clue what I'm doing and also having no plan. That's one of the things that I know not everybody has that mindset. So one of the reasons I think people fail often at getting healthier when it comes on the exercise side is like, they'll get a gym membership and go in and they just start doing whatever,
right.
You know, with no plan. So if anybody's listening, even not the best plan, even like a sort of bad plan is going to be more effective than just random stuff, you know?
Right.
But anyways, I did that. And so I started lifting a few days a week and I did that for my last couple of years in the military. I got out of the military and I continued with that. I wasn't a very big guy or anything, still kind of stayed lean. And I'm sure a lot of people can identify with in my early 20s, I could eat anything. I mean, I did, I would sometimes eat fast food 3 times a day, you know, single dude living on my own, whatever.
Right.
And so I did exercise, but it wasn't, you know, an obsessive amount or anything like that. And then I ate like complete crap. Like 26, my wife and I, my now wife, we had our first kid, which is my daughter. And once my wife got pregnant, for whatever reason, the weight just started to come on me, not her. Actually, just as much. I think for every pound she gained, I gained one, if not more than one. And by the time my daughter was 10 months old, so about a 2 year period, maybe less, I ended up going from always being lean to being 50 pounds overweight and like a 34, 35 BMI. Wow. And you know, my wife was telling me, hey, you're getting fat. And I was not processing that I'm getting fat, you know, in my mind, because I worked out a couple days a week. I'm like, oh no, I'm just putting on size or whatever, you know, but that's not really what was happening.
Right.
My waist was like 38 inches at this point. And I'm 5'8". So a 38 inch waist on a 5'8" dude, you know, and I peaked at 220 pounds and we went to the beach and she took a picture of me with my shirt off. And when I saw it, for whatever reason that day, it just hit me that, hey, she's right, I'm fat. And so at that point, for the first time, I started getting serious about the nutritional component of it. And I didn't do, after I got out of the Marine Corps, I stopped running. So this whole time I lifted a little bit, but there was no cardio, right? After being forced to run 5 to 7 miles a day, 5 days a week, yeah, I was done with it. And so what I started doing is I started doing a little bit of cardio and I cleaned up my diet. And this is a 2007-ish, around that time. And so if you read any fitness-related content or diet content at all, it was all chicken, rice, egg whites, oatmeal, you know, so the traditional bodybuilding style diet, if people are, you can picture that. And what happened is I went from 220 to about 195 in that area. So I lost about 25 pounds. So I wasn't obese anymore and I wasn't fat anymore, but I certainly wasn't lean and shredded. I lost like half what I needed to lose. And then it was just an absolute grind. It all just stopped, you know, and I kept doing the chicken and rice and broccoli and still doing my, you know, 2250 or whatever calories a day. And right. Adding more cardio. And I, we did 195 was just that new homeostasis. That's where I was at. And so I still was, you know, mildly obsessive with diet and everything. And that's just where my body fought me. And I'm sure now years later from talking to a lot of people, you know, they'll make a lifestyle change. And a lot of people have lost that 20, that 25. And then that it's like so hard to get past that. Right. So for 2 years, I kind of struggled around that same weight. And then late 2009, somebody mentioned to me, hey, you should check out a book as a trainer who passed away now. But he was just a knowledgeable trainer. And he said, hey, you should check out this book, The Warrior Diet. I read it. It's kind of got my mind going. It's really interesting. So I bought a copy and it's by a guy named Ori Hofmeekler. He never mentions any science in the book. It's very like, you know, anthropology and looking at warrior societies historically and how people evolve to eat. But I read this book and it just made sense. Like the overall premise just made sense where I'm like, hey, that, you know, 6 times a day out of Tupperware eating every 3 hours, like none of this makes sense now that I read this. And it kind of opened my eyes. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to try this. And at that point, people I know that were into working out and going to the gym and stuff, that I told them, hey, I'm going to do this. I'm going to eat one time a day. And they were like, bro, you're insane. Like your muscles are going to vaporize. You are going to disappear. Now, I wasn't like a super big dude at this time. I was just like moderately fit, you know?
Right, right.
And they're like, you're not going to gain any muscle anymore, right? You're done. And the muscle you do have is probably going to go away. And then you're going to be eating late in the evening. So you're going to get fat. They're like, this is going to make you fat. And you're going to get, you know, like basically skinnier while getting fatter. Well, you know, the whole thing's just wrong.
Right.
And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to try it anyways. Because what, and you're not going to hurt yourself in 30 days, you know? Right. So I decided I was going to do this for 30 days. So I did a 20 and four, one meal a day. And my one meal was not one sitting. I would eat the bulk of it around, you know, 5-6 o'clock in the afternoon. And then I was eating a little more at the end of that 4 hour window. But the thing that was crazy is I ended up never counting calories. And I was counting calories before. When I first lost my 25 pounds, it was Kiko. I counted everything. I was tracking everything. And it did work until metabolic adaptation happened and right. Then it all stopped. Right. So when I switched and I did 20 and four intermittent fasting, I went from 195-ish, that where I was stuck at, to 172 vascular shredded in like 6 weeks. It just flew off, dude, flew off, even though I wasn't overly fat anymore. Right. And I got super lean. And I'd fixed my diet, but I hadn't really gone down the rabbit holes of like really looking at nutrient density, any of that kind of stuff, you know. It was like I mentioned, just the standard bodybuilding fare. So once I started intermittent fasting and I saw how well it worked, it made me really interested in all of the references in the back of the book, because the book doesn't mention a whole lot scientifically, but then he backs up his hypotheses with a whole bunch of references.
Right.
And so I started looking at the references, reading the studies, and it was really fascinating. You know, all the alternate day fasting and intermittent fasting studies, and reading that stuff got me into learning about you know, ketones and beta hydroxybutyrate. And so then I, after having this initial experience with intermittent fasting, I saw the early research on more time-restricted eating and the small differences between the two. So that book, even though I don't think it's necessarily the best book from a science standpoint, right? From a conceptual standpoint, it got me into like and being interested in ancestral eating.
Yes.
And then that's where I started going down all those ancestral diet rabbit holes and, you know, ended up keto for a long time and then carnivore. And all. So that's kind of where that all came from. And post-military, I stopped doing any form of calisthenics and it was just lifting. And so where it kind of all comes together is when I started looking into ancestral eating and all that stuff, I started to, about the same time, just get tired of lifting.
Yeah.
So I was lifting because I knew from getting into the ancestral diet, that really piqued my, it was around 30 years old when this happened, that piqued my interest in realizing that we could do something to alter how we age. Yes. You know, you don't have to be 50 and be 50 biologically. Chronologically, you might be 50, but you can be 39 or 38, you know.
Right.
And so going down all those rabbit holes made me start looking at my training and thinking, okay, is this optimal for longevity and all that kind of stuff? And so since I started changing my lens from like a bodybuilding, being interested in that kind of stuff, reading bodybuilding magazines, that all ceased. And there was like a paradigm shift. And so I started adding back in, like getting really serious about pull-ups and adding that kind of stuff back in, but I still didn't look at calisthenics as a strength building methodology, right? It was just, I would go to the gym and if it's my pulling day, I'm gonna do 50 pull-ups to warm up for my back session, right? It was kind of that type of deal. I was doing bench press, but then I'm reverse pyramid with push-ups. And it was still looking at calisthenics, not from a strength building standpoint, but just a little bit of a complementary exercise to my weightlifting. But I started to lose my zest or zeal or whatever for the gym. And so I was going because I knew I needed to go, but I wasn't going because I really wanted to go, right? So I started to not enjoy the exercise. And around that time, my wife became pregnant with, this is 2014, with our second kid. And so we were going to have a little boy. And when we had our first kid, part of, I think, what made me get so fat is I'm a glutton when it comes to food, right? Like I can eat. And then also because we had a new kid, I wasn't able to get to the gym consistently. And so my activity level went down at the same time that my you know, energy intake went up. So the second time around, I thought, okay, I know how hard it is as a new dad to get to the gym consistently. And then 15 minute drive to the gym, waiting for equipment, 15 minute drive back. I just knew it wasn't realistic. And for the first year or two of my son's life, I was probably not gonna have much time to go to the gym. So I decided, okay, I'm gonna train at home. And I didn't want to go pour a bunch of money into some elaborate home gym. So what I did is I thought, okay, I'm gonna go ahead and try to do this with absolute minimal equipment. And at this time, so my daughter would have been 9, we put her in gymnastics when she was 3. And so what was kind of the catalyst that came around this time was I was getting bored of lifting because, you know, if you're bench pressing for 15 years, I mean, you're just bench pressing for 15 years. Yes, you're adding more weight. You know, you're squatting more weight, but it's not like there. I think most lifters, not everybody, I can't speak for everybody, but most people go through a time period where it becomes a drag sometimes. And I was just in one of those periods where I was just going through the motions, but taking my daughter to gymnastics practices and competitions and watching the Olympics with her, that kind of stuff, you start seeing how strong and so they're incredibly muscular, but also elite world-class levels of strength in these gymnasts.
Crazy strong.
Right. And being around gyms, I mean, gym after gym after gym, there's not a weight. They might have 20-pound, 10-pound dumbbells for when kids are doing certain weighted stretches and things like that, maybe a couple kettlebells, but there's no weights in gymnastic gyms. You know, at the NC2A level, yeah, I'm sure they start doing some deadlifting and things like that. But gymnasts build, you know, world-class strength with largely calisthenics. And so when we're going to have my son now, second time around, I had gymnastics exposure. And I thought, okay, these guys are doing iron crosses and all this stuff that are mind-blowing. If you ever even try, you know, if you actually get up on a set of rings or something and try it, you're just going to fall like a rock, dude. You can't, you know, even if you're a really strong individual, So I looked at that and I thought, well, I wonder how realistic it would be for me to try to do that stuff myself.
Yeah.
And then I wouldn't really need any equipment other than a pull-up bar. And so when my son was going to be born, I decided, okay, I've got a squat rack already. So I had a squat rack and it's got a bar across the top. I ordered gymnastics rings and I decided I'm just going to do calisthenics only for this year or year and a half, whatever. And then I'll get, see how far I can get with it. Then I'll go back to the gym when my kid's old enough. And what ended up happening was I was really good at push-ups, really good at pull-ups. And I went to try a one-arm push-up and fell on my face, you know? And I thought, okay, there's a big difference between where I'm at and the next, you know, progression or the next thing. And, but what I found was the incremental mini progressions that I found online and had to modify so I could get through it, like making those little gains and those little, I guess those little wins leading up to big wins where now you're, you know, if you ever watched Rocky and Sylvester Stallone's repping the one arms. So then you start doing stuff like that and you're like, man, this is so cool. And so for me, what made me stick with it? So the year and a half passed, my son got a little older. I could have went back to the gym. But what happened was I started seeing progress and doing new things. Like after, it took me a while, but I could finally do a handstand for a few seconds. I hadn't done a handstand since I was a kid, right?
Right.
And people look at a handstand and think, oh, that's just like you do it for fun. But handstands are incredible for building your traps, your shoulders, upper. I mean, if you look at the size of gymnast backs and shoulders, they're insane. I mean, most of them can walk out on a physique stage in place.
Yes.
You know, so I started seeing positive changes to my physique. I was actually building muscle and strength. And at the same time, I was learning new stuff that was fun. So it was the fun element to it that hooked me and made me decide, okay, I don't know if I'll lift again, but until I can do an iron cross, until I can do a front lever, a back lever, a planche, some of these things, until I can do these things, I'm going to devote myself to this craft and figure this stuff out. And then once I've got all these high level skills down and I can now do all this stuff, maybe I'll add, you know, weights back in. And part of it also is because like, there's only so much time a day to devote to training. And right. I know you do jujitsu. So most people that do jujitsu don't also lift 5 hours a week.
Right.
Because they've got five and a half hours or whatever it is a week of jujitsu to work in. So you start looking when you're doing jujitsu, it's like, okay, how can I train? But how can I also build strength and how do I balance that? And since I was wanting to do these high level calisthenic skills and they also build strength, I could add some weighted work back in, but I'm already committing an hour a day to my training and I've got kids and everything else. So it's just right. Like, what, why, you know what I mean?
Right,
so,
right.
So that's one of the things I want to make clear is I'm not like anti-lifting. I don't think body weight strength training is always better than loaded weight. It's not either or, you can do them both.
Right.
But since I'm chasing these really high level strength elements, that's where my time is invested. And that's the primary reason why I don't lift anymore. Although one day maybe I will, I have no idea. It's right. Once I've got all that stuff down and I'm not chasing anything anymore,
right.
Then maybe I will, but that's how awesome. I ended up getting into the calisthenics. And then that's why I ended up sticking with it. And then what happened online is I was mostly on Twitter to follow researchers and PhDs and exercise science guys and things like that. People that, you know, people, whether nutrition science or whatever fields, but I was mostly on Twitter as a follower to learn. I think it's an awesome medium for learning.
Yeah.
And then there's a lady, Susie Edge, I think her name, she's a doctor in Britain, I think. And she had a wrist surgery and she was having some problems. And I was like, oh, hey, let me shoot a quick video for you because there's some wrist mobility drills I do. And I shot it on Twitter and then she was like, oh, this is great. And then she shared it and it blew up for whatever reason. And so I just started getting people asking me questions and I started answering questions on Twitter and it just started growing from there. And so the whole, like, I initially made a YouTube just because Twitter's terrible for searching for content.
For right? Sure.
Like, oh, where was that video you posted? Man, I right. don't know, on Twitter. I don't know how to tell you to find it. You know?
Right, right.
So that's kind of, so the YouTube just came about from me training the way I train. And I didn't realize that there was a sizable, like, you know, niche of people that were drawn to that. And what I find, I think it's similar to my situation. People start having kids. And guys start progressing in a career and they got all these different responsibilities. And so guys are, and so most of the people that are serious, they interact with me seriously, I find are generally going to be mid 30s to mid 40s, even 50. And a lot of times they're just guys that are like, hey, I'm, yes, theoretically I could do it, but it's just not convenient for me to carve out the gym drive and then waiting on a bench in a busy gym and all the rest of that. So the efficiency, the time efficiency, I think is one of the biggest draws. And then people started asking me like, hey, how do I do what you're doing? And so that's when I had to go, well, here's how I progressed from a basic push-up through what I'm doing now. And that's kind of where the progression trees came from. So that's how it all was born, basically.
That's awesome, man. First of all, I want to say thank you for your service. Really appreciate that. But, you know, what's funny is that when I look at your pictures, I watch your videos too. And you're built like a gymnast, dude. Like that's what's, you know what I mean? Like when you're scratching your head, your bicep peak is like as high as your head is. And what I'm saying though, it's, and you're right. You're like so spot on with all that. And I can even tell you from my personal experiences that, so I'm 44. I do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I've been doing it for a long time. I train 4 or 5 days a week. And I did go to a gym. I'm still active at my gym. Or I should say I'm still paying for a membership at my gym, but I haven't been there in months. I'll be honest with you. Probably the last month and a half, 2 months, I've been watching more and more of your videos and doing that type of stuff. But you hit on so many important things when you were talking. And I think that when you had mentioned nutrition, let me ask you this. How would you gauge your genetics or your affinity to build muscle? You know, some people, you know, like for example, the example that I like to use, I always talk about, because I used to be a bodybuilder. I did it competitively in my 20s. Gotcha. But professional bodybuilders, you know, the guys that want, like, you know, for example, Mr. Olympia, the guys that won Olympia several times are usually genetic freaks, right? Like the bicep.
Yeah, you have there. To be.
Yeah, you know, but how would you consider, because when I look at you, it's like a statue, right? And other people, and you know, so how would you consider yourself? I know genetics don't tell the whole story, but how would you consider yourself in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I think in that area, I was blessed. My brothers, so I have 4 brothers, and they all have big forearms and big calves, and they're all somewhat stocky, right? We're not the naturally lean family. My dad was always had like cap delts. And I mean, my family also grew up doing physical work. So it wasn't like they're just laying around doing computer work and they're all jacked or anything like that.
Right.
But you can take two people and put them doing the same program or the same physical work, and they both won't look the same, right? You know? And actually that's one of the things I think I see that I don't like the way it's presented on Twitter and online, is you have some people that are either trainers or fitness professionals of some type. And they say like, oh, genetics don't matter. This is the program you want, or this is how you should train. Right. And the simple reality is that genetics matter a lot. Yes. With regards to how far you can take your development, or how you're going to look once you are developed. Right. So people, I'll see people that are like, oh, this is how you develop a high bicep peak. And I'm like, no, that's not how you develop a high bicep peak. Your biceps are what they are.
Right.
You're going to train them. You're going to contract. You're going to build your biceps, and they're going to look how they're going to look.
Exactly. Like,
you don't go, oh, this makes it higher and this makes it longer. This doesn't work that way, you know?
Right.
But yeah, so my parents were not the best parents. Could have been better. But I did get blessed with good genetics. Like my dad's super intelligent, even though he's not well educated. He's a smart guy, and like I said, always stocky and all that. So definitely, I'm always honest with people. I would never try to present that I have average genetics for hypertrophy. Right. So the average person's going to go train and look like me. That's probably not the case. I'm sure I'm in the upper some odd percentile of genetics. But the thing that's important is, just like in school, there's kids that don't even have to study and they just like have a memory that's insane, right? Yes. And they barely try and they're getting a 4.0.
Exactly.
Yeah, you maybe won't be that kid, but could you still be a surgeon? Yeah, if you bust your ass.
Absolutely.
Right? Could you still be an attorney? Yeah, if you bust your ass. So maybe maybe the hand you were dealt in life is such that you're gonna have to work harder than that guy to get to be the same profession or the same grades or whatever, but you can still do it. Right. So when it comes to genetics, I always tell people, yeah, maybe you're not going to have a chest. Like people say, well, I want a chest like yours. Well, maybe that's not in the cards for you,
right?
But you can still have a damn fine chest,
right?
And you're just going to have to put in the work and let your, it's kind of like a sculpture, right? Your body's going to develop in whatever way it's going to develop, but you can still, whatever your genetic potential is, you can still reach that.
Right.
So, and if you don't have good genetics for hypertrophy, yeah, it's probably not going to be, you know what I mean? Your ultimate, like your top end goal is probably not, maybe not going to, like you mentioned, the guys that are bodybuilding at the high levels and stuff, like obviously that takes a lot of steroids, but
of course,
but I mean, but even naturally, yeah, you may not have the same potential as another person, be it man or woman,
right?
But you can still, there's nobody, if you eat well and you train intelligently, there's nobody that can't look like a beast, right? There's no woman that can't look phenomenal. There's no guy that won't look phenomenal. It's just, yeah, maybe you're going to have the longer, leaner musculature. Maybe you're not going to be as thick. There's, you know, there's some stuff like that to it.
Right.
So I like to try to be careful. I don't want to discourage somebody. Oh, you got crap genetics. You're never going to get anywhere. Right. Cause that's not how it works. You can still get results. It's just relative to another person. It may not be similar relative to another person. So hopefully that's kind of clear.
You know, the first bodybuilding show that I did, I was 20, 21 or 22. And I did it solely to see how ripped I can get. That was the only reason why. And I got out of undergrad and I lived with three guys and we all worked at the same place. Well, I had a couple of jobs, but we all worked at the same place and everybody trained, you know, we lifted, but I ended up hooking up with another guy at the gym I trained with. And, you know, I noticed him over a couple of months getting leaner and leaner and leaner. And I asked him one, his name was Chris, ended up being a good friend of mine. I said, so are you, you know, I said, you look great, man. Like you're cutting down, you know, he's like, oh yeah, I'm doing a show. I'm competing, you know? So long story short with that, I started competing. And my first show was just, I remember I signed up for it. And I said to myself, if I sign up for it, I know I'll know that I'll get in good enough shape. Now at that point, cause I did train a lot. I lifted a lot. I had enough muscle that I could afford to lose the weight. Right. So, that's the reason why I did my first show. And then, you know, if I'm being honest, it's kind of like a, you know, you start looking good, it becomes kind of a vanity thing, you know?
Yeah.
And for me, well, at least it was for me when I was in my 20s and you start looking good, you start cutting up. And then you I always tell people, you know, I trained for 6 months, cutting and like I chicken, rice and broccoli 6 times a day. And when I was driving to work, one of my jobs, I drove over an hour. And on my way to work, I was eating out of my Tupperware, you know, to
get
my
cold chicken. Yeah. I would never do that again, man.
Oh,
never.
So bad. So bad. But, so I remember doing that. And then for 6 months, just to be on stage for 30 seconds, you know, and then that was it. And then I'd blow up again in the off season and I cut back down. And I did that for several years. But anyway, obviously, with the nutrition part about it. And I think that my experience is similar to yours, Jerry, where I kind of found my own way. I mean, a doctor a long time ago helped my mother, but you know, he was in my opinion, a cutting edge guy. So he had a lot of good things to say even back then. But, for me, you know, nutrition is extraordinarily important. And I guess for you, I remember you had tweeted a couple of times, you know, how you eat. But are you currently, you're not currently on a carnivore diet, right?
No, I'm basically, I was from, I first tried it December 2018 and late December 2018. And then I did it initially for 30 days. I had a skin condition that was progressively getting worse for 3.5 years. And I'd gotten some anti-steroidal creams and stuff like that. But you know, if you have like, if anybody's ever had psoriasis or anything like that, they don't even understand fully what causes it. So there's not a cure. There are band-aids that they can give you, but beyond creams, which you got to cycle, you can't take them all the time. You know, there's immunosuppressant therapies and things like that, but I wasn't that bad yet. Right. But it was slowly progressing. And so I kept seeing my first, even being an ancestral diet guy, I'd done keto for a long time at this point, intermittent fasting forever. When I saw, you know, Sean Baker and some of the carnivores, in my mind, I'm like, man, these guys are nuts. You know, like you got to have greens, you got to have veggies, you know?
Right.
And, but I started seeing anecdotes of people that were saying like, hey, I've got this autoimmune condition. I've got this skin problem. And you know, when I went carnivore, it cleared up. And I knew, cause one thing I've always been pretty good about is trying to look at something and then say, okay, well, what other mechanisms could have caused this? And I'm thinking, well, if you go from a SAD diet to any other diet, and there's a reduction in energy and you start to lose weight, there can be positive changes, you know. But I kept seeing enough people that were getting relief, and some of them intelligent people that were already eating well for a while, you know, if you've looked around the carnivore space. So I decided, okay, I don't know how ideal it is long-term, but I'm going to try it for 30 days and see what happens. And within that 30 days, my skin cleared up completely after about 3.5 weeks.
Awesome.
And then I had 20 years of GERD that I, you know, battled on and off. I mean, I guess not really off, but it would be worse at some points and less at others, but I had GERD for 20 years and that almost completely resolved to where it's was a very occasional, very mild, you know, occurrence. And I thought, man, the reductions in GERD are crazy. My skin's clear. I'm going to stick with this and research more into it. And then one thing that I already had believed, and I still think this, if you look at, you know, human biology, there, you as an organism, a lot of what happens in your body is governed by the energy state of you. And then at a smaller level, the energy state of organs or cells, right? You have these different levels. And so one of the things I've thought for a long time is I think superfoods is mostly stupid.
Yeah.
You know, I do think there's some interesting research coming out on polyphenols and things like that. Maybe there's some science there. It's all early, you know.
Right.
But so I've never been one to like bash vegetables. Hey, nobody should be eating vegetables. But because I had autoimmune issues, I do think there's people for whom they're way better off to not eat them, you know, especially if they're not sure which ones trigger their conditions and things like that. But one thing that I think you're, you know, educated in biology yourself, right? So one of the things I think, if you understand that, like, your a lot of the so-called longevity pathways at a cellular level, those things are activated by stress. They can be nutrient stress. So when you're in an energy deficit from exercise or you're in an energy deficit from diet, you know, regardless of what kind of diet it is, then certain metabolic pathways are activated that are going to lead to huge improvements in health.
Right.
So to me, I already kind of knew instinctively, you know, just from how your body operates, it's not like, oh, if I eat more, you know, kale, I'm going to live longer. Or if I eat more of a certain thing, you know what I mean? So when I first went carnivore, in my mind, I thought, okay, if I am spending time in an energy deficit, then I know that these longevity pathways, you know, you're up regulating these different things. So the common health benefits between caloric restriction, then even if you go ketogenic, right? That stuff, it doesn't matter. Eat a steak, eat salmon, eat whatever.
Right.
If you still have the energy restriction, you're still seeing the health benefits. So for me, I think that by far the biggest, you know, levers that you can pull for health are going to be in, you know, physical activity for a whole bunch of different reasons. And then, you know, whether it's, if you're a guy that likes to go run cross country, man, have at it, right?
Right.
If you love jujitsu, have at it. All physical activity is very strongly correlated to human longevity in every study they've ever done.
Yes.
So I know there's a subset of people who think that if they eat the right diet, they don't need to exercise. And I do think you can be healthy without exercise. There's healthy people that don't exercise. That's fine. I'm not going to argue that.
Right.
Again, as long as you spend time in energy restricted state and the rest of that stuff. But when you start looking at what gives you the best chance for optimal health, and you start looking at human longevity, strength is very strongly correlated. Yes. Your cardiovascular health is very strongly correlated. So there are distinct benefits. Muscle mass is strongly correlated. So there's all these things that if you don't exercise, and you can probably get away with it till about 40, 45, because sarcopenia is not bothering you yet.
Right.
But no matter how you eat, when you hit 70, you're going to deteriorate without physical activity, right?
Right.
So to me, the reason I mentioned all that, when I went carnivore, I knew going into it, hey, I'm not a world, you know, class expert on this. So I couldn't tell you if there is a legitimate benefit to eating vegetables that's going to make a functional difference in your longevity.
Right.
But I can tell you that exercise and energy deficit, all that stuff, that's going to make a functional difference in your longevity.
Right.
So I knew going into it, I'm a physically active dude. I strength train, I run, not in the summer because I live in hell in the summer, so I don't run, but I like going outdoors. Our fall, winter, and spring are beautiful here. So I go jog a few miles a couple days a week, more than just to get outside and take in some atmosphere, you know, but knowing that the other things I do in life are activating all these, you know, longevity pathways for me. Like I thought, okay, if I'm not eating, you know, broccoli, if I'm not getting sulforaphane, whatever else, it probably doesn't matter one bit.
Right.
It honestly probably doesn't matter. And maybe that stuff matters more if you're not physically active, if you don't exercise, if you're sedentary. So that was my reasoning behind, okay, I'm going to go from this 30-day carnivore experiment to a longer-term carnivore diet. And I stuck with it for like 7 months strict.
Nice.
After 30 days, I did add seasoning. So I would season my steaks and stuff other than just salt. But aside from just seasoning, which I had no issues. I had no recurrence of my skin conditions. After 7 months, what I found is I one day I was eating ground beef and salt, and I just didn't want to eat it anymore. Like, just instantly, I was like, okay, I'm done with this.
Okay.
And so I decided starting today, I'm going to put onions and garlic in my ground beef bowls. So I sauteed onions and garlic, and I did that for 2 weeks, made eating ground beef much more enjoyable.
Right.
And I had no issues. And so I was obviously tolerating that fine. So then I got some cilantro, which I know is polarizing for people, but I like it. So I threw some cilantro in my ground beef bowls for 2 weeks, and I was cool. So nice. Then I bought some, I love spicy food, and there's these, so I bought chipotle peppers and threw those in my ground beef. And, so I'll do like ground beef bowls with chipotles, onions, garlic. And then a little while after that, I added avocados in.
Okay.
And so if you just picture a chipotle bowl with no grains,
that sounds amazing, man.
That's about right. So I'll do that. But if I eat a steak, dude, I just eat a steak. I don't need vegetable. Right. I don't need anything with my steak. If I'm eating salmon, I just eat a bunch of salmon, you know.
Right.
If I'm eating bacon and eggs, I'm just eating bacon and eggs. I don't need anything else. So I would say I'm probably, for lack of a better term, like northern latitude hunter-gatherer these days. So I eat most of my calories from animal foods, but then I do use plants as meat enhancers.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of plants in my diet, but I do throw them in my ground beef bowls, and I will use them. Like, we'll do cheese shell tacos. And I'll throw some onions and cilantro and stuff in my tacos. Nice. That kind of thing.
You know, I'm with you on that. I'd say that I'm probably right where you are. Let me ask you this, Jerry. Did you ever figure out kind of what was doing that with your skin?
So one thing that I was doing is I was already keto at the time. So I was doing intermittent fasting with about 125 grams of carbs a day for a long time. And one thing that people want to, I like to, you know, make people realize is if you think about, you've got your classical medical ketogenic diet, which is very low carbohydrate because the goal is to mimic the beta hydroxybutyrate or the blood ketone levels of a fast. So when people have, you know, basically neurological conditions that cause seizures and things like that, in order to get relief from those symptoms, it's not just about reducing glucose, it's about getting ketone levels to a certain point.
Right.
And so a lot of those people, they find that I got to be at 1.5 millimolar of BHB. I got to be at 2.5, whatever it is for that individual. Those people need to chase ketones.
Yes.
But for a normal person, having higher blood ketones, now they are, in my experience, they're great for suppressing appetite.
Mm-hmm.
So having a higher ketone production may lead to less energy intake because your appetite is lower and your energy levels are really high. And so I do think there's people who will overall get a better functional result from a high beta hydroxybutyrate levels in their diet because they're going to eat less and they're going to have better macronutrient setup. You know what I mean? But at the same time, I was eating 125 grams of carbs a day and I was still at 0.8 millimolar most of the time when I would check my blood. So I was in ketosis at 125 grams of carbs a day, but I was exercising 45 minutes an hour a day. Right.
Right.
If you don't exercise, that's going to be harder for you to, you're going to have to be way more careful with your carbohydrate intake in a ketogenic diet. So the reason I mention that is, you know, for most people, a ketogenic diet, that just means doing whatever puts you into a state of ketosis.
Right.
And so you often see people that are like, well, I got to be below 25 carbs a day. And if you're strict carnivore, you're going to be at almost zero, maybe a little dairy, but you're going to be a bit functionally, you know, zero carbs a day.
Right.
Outside of carnivore, if you're just trying to do a keto diet, if you actually check your blood, you may very well be able to eat 75 grams of carbs a day or 100 grams of carbs a day and still be in a ketogenic diet.
Right.
So that's just something to throw out there that I learned from monitoring my own blood.
Yeah.
So I got off track. What were you?
No, that's okay. I was thinking, no, that's good stuff. And that's exactly right. And I think it's important. You know, I personally don't look at my ketones. I don't prick myself or anything like that, but you're right though. And a lot of people I know, I don't know her real name. I know her as Caesar Salad on Twitter. You know
yeah, I mean? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And for somebody like her, which amazing with that, where she's come from, where she was. So somebody like that, I totally get it. But no, what I was wondering about you was, did you ever, because so for me personally, I did the carnivore diet for about a year and like 3 months. And I loved it. And
yeah, then you ate a Reese's peanut butter cup and lost like 1,000 followers.
That's exactly right. By the way, kind of, you know, adding on to how you eat, I'm pretty much carnivore adjacent. I do eat zucchini. I eat cucumber. I eat avocado every now and then. And then once in a, I mean, probably I'm not exaggerating. I literally, whenever I eat something that I typically don't eat, I post it, which is very rare. Right.
Right.
But I do, and maybe once every couple of months, or whenever we feel like it, we'll have something, whatever the heck that we want. You know, if we want a pizza, we're going to have a pizza, something like that. But what I was wondering about you was, did you notice, or did you find out what was causing the issues or a certain
food? Oh, that's right. Yeah. So I went grain free, when I went keto, it's obviously, but I made sure I was grain free keto. I saw an improvement to my GERD, and I think it probably, when you have carbohydrates, there's a lot of extra food volume and a lot of vegetation. You know, you got more food volume there, putting pressure on the sphincter and all that, you know. So I saw some improvement there. But what I did was, I was still eating when I was keto prior to the carnivore switch. I was, because I thought, well, I've got to have leafy greens, right? Super important to have leafy greens. So what I was doing is, I was eating already heavy meat keto, but I was doing a lot of kale, and I was doing a lot of spinach, kale. I was doing dark chocolate. And then when I would have carbohydrates here and there, I was doing sweet potato. And one of the things that's common amongst all those foods is it's high in oxalate. And so I guess it's, you know, I don't have no way for me to know for sure, but theoretically, maybe I got to a point where I had additional oxalate skin. There could have been a link there, but that was the only vegetables I was eating with any consistency. Was I would come home, I'd throw spinach and I'd throw kale together in a bowl, toss some olive oil, chop an avocado, and I would eat a huge salad. Then I'd have a steak or whatever. Right. And that was pretty much what I would eat. And so when I did make the switch to carnivore, the only vegetables I was eating were those salads. And when I dropped those, everything within 2 days, the itching started to subside. So it was definitely something in those couple of vegetables that was causing the issue. Yeah. And once I cut those out, and then since going back, I've not eaten that stuff anymore. But I did, peanuts caused my skin to flare. Luckily it wasn't, I mean, I tried it once, a handful of peanuts, and started to get some itchy in between the fingers, and it started to turn slightly pink. And I was like, okay, I'm not messing with peanuts.
Yeah, that's nice.
But you know, I'm probably similar to you on a daily basis. I don't cheat, so to speak, on, if you, I don't know what to call it, carnivore adjacent, low carb diet. I don't really cheat on that, with the exception of, like, I got a 14-year-old daughter. My wife doesn't care for sushi, but my daughter loves it. So once in a while we'll go, and once in a while it's like every other month or something. Right. We'll go buy like 3 or 4 rolls and just share them. Nice. And I don't have to do that, but like, I'm a dad first. If my kid wants sushi, I'm gonna go eat some sushi. If that offends somebody, oh well, man, no, don't worry about it. Right. And so, but I'm the type of person where I mean, I'm from California, not Texas, but I can get down on making a good brisket. Like, I do a really good pulled pork. So the foods that I'm good at making, cause I think for most men that I know, like most dudes I know, like, one of the biggest tragedies in life is when you don't cook meat right. It doesn't come out good. And you're just like, dude, you're bummed, dude, till the next day.
Totally. Yes.
So the foods that I'm good at making, like, it's not rice, dude. It's really not. Like, right. I'm not making expert rice. You know what I mean? Right. I don't know how to make sushi at home. Like, I'm not a teppanyaki chef or any of that. So I'm content to just have good steak, you know, not good salmon, pulled pork, brisket, whatever, do bacon and eggs. I'm pretty simple in that regard. Yeah. And the once in a while when I will eat outside of, you know, an ancestral type diet is if we're going to a really good sushi spot, me and my daughter, or on our anniversary, we went to the steakhouse who has the best cheesecake, dude. It's really good. And so we just got one big piece and shared it. But going back to me being a former fat dude, if that stuff was in my house, I would still be a fat dude. I lack the self-control. Like, if you know, you have your, I guess if it fits your macros, and, you know, coming from bodybuilding in the past, yeah, I always tell people that does work. I've seen it work over Absolutely. And over. But Absolutely. The problem is, it only works for the people that are pig-headed enough
Yes.
To do a bodybuilding show, like, you have to have that kind of tenacity. Right. And the problem is, you know, we are people of limited willpower.
Yes.
And if you go back to the 70s, you go back to the 60s, people just ate their cultural food and nobody was fat, right? Because they ate higher protein, there's more steak, it was less processed food, it didn't hijack your satiety signals.
Right.
So what I always try to tell people is, like, we live in an era where we're in an obesogenic environment. And if you just go with the flow, you're probably going to get fat.
Right.
Right. Where maybe our fathers or grandfathers, they just went with the flow and weren't fat. You know,
right.
it just point. Is what it is. It's yeah. it's just the way it is. It's not fair or whatever, but it's the way it is, you know?
Right.
And so I'm the type of guy where I'm not going to do the, if it fits your macros thing, and have like one Pop-Tart or four Oreos, because I'm going to eat both Pop-Tarts in the package.
Right.
And I'm going to eat the whole sleeve of Oreos dipped in milk.
Yeah.
It's just the way I am, you know?
Yeah.
And so since I recognize that about myself, I don't hate on the Lane Norton type people who can do that diet. That's fine for them.
Right.
Awesome. Have at it. Like, I'm glad you can do that. Right.
Right. And he looks great, by the way. I've seen
pictures of
him. Yeah, absolutely.
But I think there's a subset of the population, and maybe it's 10% or 50. I don't know what percentage it is, but it's not the majority. Because the problem is, the majority of people, when, if you were doing a diet in that style, and if it says you can have 4 ounces of ice cream, dude, I'm just getting started at 4 ounces of ice cream. So, you know what I mean?
Right.
Two slices of pizza. No, there's no such thing as two slices. Like, you know what I mean? So, so for me, when I do deviate from my diet, it's very controlled, and it's always at a restaurant. It's not at my house.
Right.
And that way I can't go past my plate, because I'm not going to order another plate of food. You know?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's where I've learned if I'm going to deviate, that's the way I would deviate. I don't have all the crap in the house like that. So yeah, that's where I'm at.
Same with us. I will say, and I can't say that we don't really keep that stuff in the house either. The only thing that I know that my wife, she's not on a carnivore diet. My son, he eats fruit. He eats meat. His favorite food to eat is beef and a sweet potato. That's what he loves. That's his, like, his go-to, but he eats fruit. The only thing that we keep in the house regularly, we have that, I think it's 90 or 95% dark chocolate. I'm not a fan of it. But I will be honest with you, you know, for me personally, and I don't think that I have any special willpower. I know that a lot of people aren't like this. So, for example, I have patients that'll say, if I have one vacation meal, one cheat meal, whatever the case is, it's going to throw me into a 2 month downward spiral. You know, that doesn't happen to me. You know, I could eat two Reese's cups, and I'll be honest, it tastes wonderful, but it makes me feel like shit. And I'll be okay with it, because I know how it makes me feel, but I won't have it again for a while. You know what I mean? But it won't send me down this road. I know a lot of people that it will.
Right.
So I'm with you on that. And even too, the things for me that I like to eat, I just happen to be healthy. Like, I love meat, right?
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah.
You know, so it's not like I feel like I'm missing something. One thing I always kind of chuckle at on social media, and a lot of these guys I follow because they have good content and I love them, but I always kind of crack up when I see these guys put these things out there where they say, oh, you know, this client, they lost 30 pounds and they did this. They ate carbs every day. You know, they were like, you know, they were allowed to eat carbs, as if not eating carbs is all that restrictive. And I don't know that it is, but like you said, if you're the type of person that if it fits your macros, and I did that, here's my problem with it. I think eventually in my personal experience, and even with patients, Jerry, is that so I think that you can willpower your way for a few months, but hunger, I think, eventually gets us. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's just my thought on that.
Most of the guys that I know that, like, I've got a buddy who's a power lifter, but he's lean. He's for a power lifter, he's lean anyways. I have a buddy that does bodybuilding competitions and stuff like that. You know, from spending years at the gym, you meet guys, and now with social media, everybody kind of sees what everybody else is doing. And what I will say is, there's not an exception. Every dude I know who, like, macro diets, who does, like, if it fits your macros, what they do without exception from my experience is when they have a goal, oh, I got a meet coming up and I got my weight classes this, they are, dude, it's on point, right? And they get there, but they don't maintain the conditioning very long. And now competitive bodybuilders, nobody can stay 3% body fat. It's not even healthy to do so. So they purposely don't stay that lean after the show.
Right.
But the reason that bodybuilding like that's not really never appealed to me too much is once I started getting healthy and I started looking into like ancestral diet, I want to look good all the time. Not from, and when I was in my 20s, yeah, there's a vanity component to it. And I think you all, there is, we're a visual species. So yeah, anybody's lying if they say, oh, I don't care if I'm fat, dude, whatever. It doesn't matter what I look like. You know, obviously everybody wants to look healthy. And I mean, and I do think visually health and vitality, it looks appealing when somebody's healthy and they look healthy. You know what I mean? Now, professional bodybuilders on stage don't even look healthy. They're so shredded. It's another level of
and their stomachs these days too.
Oh, it's disgusting. But, but the reason I mention that is most of the people I see that do a macro style diet, they don't do that year round and stay lean year round. Most of them, the problem is they eat these foods on a consistent basis, like you said. And when they've got a goal, my buddies that compete in bodybuilding and stuff, they've got a show, they look phenomenal. But after the show, they get fat. And in off season, they're kind of fat. Like if you see these guys in the off season, they're muscly dudes. I mean, you're not going to see them and think they don't work out. But you would, even the guys that bodybuild, you'd look at him and think, oh, it looks like a big power lifter and he's a bodybuilder.
Jerry, when I, in the off season, when I was doing it, I got up to about 245 and I competed. Now this was after I weighed in and I probably gained a few pounds, right? Because you dehydrate yourself and you don't drink water. And, you know, I competed, I think I was light heavyweight. I was no heavier than 198. I was 245 in the off season, but I looked like I worked out, was just doughy and puffy. You know what I mean? Now I'm like in the 180s. I don't even know what, but you don't stay lean that whole entire time.
Yeah. And a lot of it is, you know, my buddy Kale, dude's a beast, super, he's a cop. He's a great guy, but he was a wrestler in high school and college. So wrestlers already starve and binge kind of that mentality. But then, you know, he did a bodybuilding show. He did some powerlifting. The guy's a freak athlete, so he just does all this different stuff. He does Spartan races and things like that.
Wow.
But just as one example of, you know, when he's off and not doing the if it fits your macros type deal, he still eats, but instead of one Pop-Tart, now it's three, or instead of, you know, now it's Cold Stone quadruple scoops of ice cream.
Right.
So most of the guys I know that do the macro style dieting, and it's not all, because again, I think there's the human psychology varies amongst people. But I do see a bigger tendency for those guys to get super on the unhealthy side when it comes to body composition, when they're not actually prepping for something. Yes. You know, where when you eat more of an ancestral approach where you're not eating that crap, like except me in your case, it's a rare thing and you moderate it like that. But I think that when you just don't have it, what happens is you run the risk of when that can be in your diet every day, even when you're dieting. And so every day I can have a little ice cream, a little bowl of cereal. Once you're not dieting anymore, it's not a little bowl of cereal anymore. And it's not a little bit of ice cream anymore. You're still eating that every day. But those foods are so high in fat and in carbohydrate together. But like you just mentioned, I think that's the key. They're crappy for satiety. So you eat more, but you're not full, right? So I think that as soon as you stop counting the calories and measuring the intake, that type of diet is an absolute disaster.
Yes.
Right. So to me, So to me, I think you could take anybody, and as long as they don't have it where, and I'm kind of like you, where if we were to go out and have sushi, I come home, I go to sleep, dude, I'm super full. I just knock out. Mm-hmm. I wake up the next day, I fast all day. I don't want to eat more crap food. I'm done. Like that was it.
Right.
And that's, but if I woke up, and honestly, if I woke up and had four more rolls in my fridge, I'm going to eat them the next day. So to me, it's a matter of planning that if I'm going to do it, and then not having the food around after that, and I'm good. I just don't set myself up in a situation to fail. But when you make eating, not that sushi is terrible, but when you make eating it's not processed, but when you're eating highly processed food as part of your diet every day, if you ever get to a point where you're no longer counting and tracking everything, like I would almost be willing to guarantee you're going to get fat.
Dude, that's such a good point, man. That is such a good way to put it. Like, and you're 100% right. Never thought of it like that. Excuse me. Where it's like you said, when you stop counting, you're counting lousy food, right? And I don't, you know, I don't know that I would say that I was on You know, the bodybuilding diet for me was the same thing. It was, you know, chicken, rice, and broccoli. But I remember I was meeting with a guy every Friday that was looking at my body fat, that was looking, he was a bodybuilder himself. He was making sure that I was, you know, on the up and up, everything was looking okay. And he would say, okay, so Nick, next week have this many more grams of carbohydrates per day. You're looking a little flat this week. Or if I came in a little bit, you know, too much water, you know, you cut this back. But dude, that's such a strong point. You know, if you're counting lousy food, once you're no longer counting, it's just lousy in general. So that's a really good point. Now, are you doing still doing Warrior diet, still like 24? Is that what you're doing?
No, so these days it just depends on how I feel on a given day. I don't have like a specific so I really like bacon and eggs. I don't know how you know.
Who doesn't, man, right?
Yeah. So I like that. A lot of people just are not breakfast food people in the first place. Like, you know, I have a buddy who is in phenomenal shape and he just doesn't like eggs. So he's just never been a breakfast person regardless. He just, right. You know, cause he says there's no breakfast food that he really cares for.
Right.
In my case, I really do like bacon and eggs and I don't mind eating them at 5 PM or whatever, but right. They just taste better in the morning. Like it's just breakfast food, you know?
So, for sure.
So there's days, I'd say my average breakfast I usually will eat some bacon and eggs around 10 in the morning. So it's not like super early, but around 10. And then I try to cut off eating somewhere around 6, but I've got kids. Sometimes it's later and we go 7 or 8, you know what I mean? So I still do condense it into like an abbreviated window,
yeah.
But I wouldn't really consider it wholesale fasting.
Right.
But some days I'm busy in the mornings and I'm not hungry and I just won't eat. You know what I mean? Right. Some days I'll go till 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. It just depends. But on majority of days, it's somewhere around 10, 11 in the morning, I'll have bacon and eggs. And that's my usually my first meal.
Nice. Yeah, you know, I'll be honest with you. When I first started doing intermittent fasting, I did it on purpose. I started on purpose. You know, I remember I made a decision on a Sunday that, okay, tomorrow on Monday, I'm doing noon, 4 and 8 PM, and I'm going to fast for 16 hours. And then after a while, you know, it just, you're not hungry. If you're eating the right foods, you're not hungry until noon the next day. And then over right. the time, I made my window shorter, not on purpose, just because I wasn't hungry. I will be honest, I fasted for 9 days years ago, and the last probably 2 or 3 days was forced. You know, I was hungry, and the only reason why I went 9 is because I said I was going to do it. But I typically nowadays are usually only one meal, maybe more. The only change that I've made, and again, I got used to it because I was eating my one meal about 5:30. But then I recently, and it took me a few weeks to kind of, for my body, I just eat a little bit earlier and I don't eat past 3 o'clock anymore. And for me, again, this isn't advice. I'm not recommending anybody that does this, but for me, I noticed that most of all, my sleep was way better. And I typically slept well to begin with. So
right.
I think that's the only thing for me that I changed with that whole thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's research from the Salk Institute, you know, on early time restricted feeding, and they compared a noon to 8, which is a popular window. I'm pretty sure in the study it was noon to 8, but they compared noon to 8 with 8 to 2. Because I read it a couple years ago, but I think it was 8 in the morning till 2 p.m. and they cut eating off at 2 p.m. And so it was the same. It was 8 to 8. So maybe I'm off a little bit. I can't remember, but it was, they cut the one window off as an 8-hour window ending at 2 p.m. and the other one was an 8-hour window ending at 8 p.m. And the group with the earlier eating window, they did have better sleep based on whatever mark, you know, however they were measuring it. And there was some improvement in insulin sensitivity or how it worked. The thing is, with those studies, they're taking people that are eating a mixed diet. So they're eating carbohydrates.
Right.
And so I would love to see a similar study done with an early feeding window and a late feeding window where both groups are, you know, 50 grams of carbs or less, more ketogenic. Right. Because then I wonder if the early morning insulin sensitivity matters as much if you're not taking right. in carbohydrate in the first place.
Right.
But yeah, that's kind of where my window on most days is still about 8 hours because I will normally try to eat around 6, but I start eating around 10. So a lot of people are eating more 7 or 8. They start eating at right. noon. At the end of the day, the window is similar. So, right. but it's just that, you know, intermittent fasting, I guess I did one meal a day for, or 20 and 4 for a long time. I think it was 4 years I did that. And so when I'm eating for 8 or 9 hours, I don't really even consider that any type of fasting.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's not really much of a fast. So.
Right. Well, I mean, I think too, you know, depending on who you ask, they talk about assimilation, you know, the type of food that you eat and how long it takes to digest. So if you know, if you eat at, let's say 4 p.m., the fast doesn't officially start till 7 or whatever the case is. But I mean, listen, I think like what you said and a lot of others have said is, you know, if you're participating in lifestyle things that are, that you know, that are going to help with longevity or, you know, the right pathways for longevity, you know, lowering mTOR when, you know, not all the time, of course, in the right places, you know, being insulin sensitive. And listen, I think it was maybe me, you, somebody else, I don't know who it was on Twitter recently. We were talking about, you know, exercise and autophagy, you know, you know, maybe it was Ted Naiman. Somebody
You know what? I'm glad you said that, because we would have ran the risk of having a whole podcast without mentioning autophagy, which would have been a crime.
Oh my goodness! He's, by the way, man, you're one of the cleverest dudes that I know on Twitter. It's hilarious, dude. It's awesome.
It was funny. But, I got to figure out how to do it. So when I first started making my YouTube, I got to remember, not everybody's on YouTube is following on Twitter. Not everybody on Twitter follows YouTube. You know. So I mostly just make like short, direct, to the point tutorial videos on YouTube, which is totally cool. But then I have people that follow me on Twitter and they're like, man, you gotta get some sarcasm over on your YouTube. Like, you know, you gotta let your personality come out a little bit. So I contemplated doing some vlog type stuff.
Yeah.
Just cause I have people that are like, well, I'd like to see a whole day of eating, or, you know, like just a day in the life type. So I'm gonna try to get some of that kind of stuff up.
Awesome.
But yeah, one of the things that like you and I have joked about for a long time is, I'm not sure how it started or where it became popular, but people seem to think that like you have no autophagy going on, right? It's just off. And then you fast by drinking only water and coffee. Coffee's okay. But you drink only coffee or water. And if you have like 2 carbohydrates, all autophagy stops or didn't start. And then you got to keep fasting for that many more hours because you ate anything other than water. And then like once you hit 16 hours of fasting, all of a sudden the autophagy floodgate is opened and it, you know.
Right.
And like from right away, I was like, where is this coming from? Because, you know, like, so what people got to realize is, you know, what we mentioned earlier, you have the energy state of the organism. Then you have the energy state of your cell, each cell. And of course your different organs, your liver, your kidneys, whatever. But what happens is you have these different processes going on at a cellular level to keep your body functioning properly, keep the cell functioning properly. And in a perfect world, everything's happening the way it's supposed to happen. And as we get older, those things happen less efficiently. And a really important point to that is, as we get older, those things should probably be happening less efficiently way later than they are. But our modern lifestyle of lack of physical activity and never being in a negative energy balance, always overeating. But the reason I mentioned that like autophagy is not just on or off is because like if you don't eat protein, you're going to have a deficiency of amino acids. And what's going to happen is your cells actually have to have amino acids or you die. Like you can't not have them. Right. So the cells say, okay, we need amino acids. Where are we going to get them? Okay, let's start recycling some intracellular structures. Let's break down some of these protein structures to get amino acids to continue functioning. And so one of the ways to increase autophagy would be just eat less protein. You could do a low protein approach and you would see an increase in autophagy. And of course, when you fast, you're automatically low protein during the fasting period, right? But one of the other things is if you restrict carbohydrate, you also need glucose. Right? So intracellular glucose, if you're in a ketogenic diet, or if you're in a low carbohydrate diet, you have a deficit in glucose production. The cell, it's a similar mechanism where your body is sensing glucose levels. It's sensing, you know, as a matter of fact, there's new research showing lactate is a cellular messaging molecule. There's these different substrate that your body's basically sensing, including amino acids, including glucose, including the overall energy state of the organism, just good old fashioned caloric restriction.
Right.
So if you just restrict calories, you see an increase in autophagy. You don't have to fast. Now, I don't have a lab. I'm not testing this on humans. I understand like Jason Fung, certain people, there are people who are doing blood work and who, as a fast progresses and all that stuff, yes, that, hey, you probably are higher in autophagy, which makes sense because the bigger the overall energy deficit is, the more that flux in autophagy is likely going up. So like right. that, but the whole point is, and this is something to think about, let's say you did a complete water fast for 7 days and you get this high level of autophagy, for example, for a week. Now, if you ate half that many calories, so you did a just 50% energy restriction, and let's just say it was ketogenic for 7 days, right. for 14 days, I'm sorry. So you just do it longer. But if yes. you did it for 14 days instead of seven, so let's just say you got half the autophagy for twice as long. We have no idea if that's better, if that's worse.
Right.
Is two times the is half the autophagy for twice the length the same thing? Right. And that's the thing we don't know. And, yeah. you know, so that's where I think it's just an important point is like, if you exercise regularly, you are taking advantage of autophagy already, independent right. of diet.
Right.
To a degree. And then if you just restrict carbohydrate or you just restrict protein, you're forcing that cell to have to adapt. And so I think it's just important to point out that autophagy is not just an on and off switch. And you don't, yes. it's not like, well, because I see people, they're like, well, I'm not intermittent fasting right now, or I'm doing a 10-hour feeding window, so I know I'm not getting autophagy. And I'm like, oh, yes, you are.
You're not dead, right?
Right, and yeah. we don't even know, there's a lot we don't know how much we need or
right.
if one method is better than another. And until we have like probably much easier tests to run that are right. not proxy, you know what I mean?
Right.
So there's a lot people don't know. So with that being said, if you're like, well, I want to take advantage of autophagy, number one, you should be exercising. Like that's low hanging fruit. Yes. And if you want a water fast for a prolonged period, have at it. That's definitely going to ramp it up because that's the ultimate energy deprivation. If you don't want a water fast for days on end, then intermittent fasting, while the overall days are still in an energy deficit, that's probably, right. in all honesty, is probably going to be very similar.
Right.
So
I agree. Yeah. And I'll be honest with you. There's a lot of people out there smarter than me that, you know, are talking about those things. And I remember, I wish my goodness, I can't remember who said it, but recently on Twitter, they said a little bit of exercise regarding autophagy, a little bit of exercise is better than a lot of fasting.
Right.
And that's fantastic. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I can't believe it took us this long to talk about autophagy. You know? We got through like over an hour just the A word just came up. Jerry, real quick before we go, buddy, and just while we go, just hang on for a second off air. I want to say a couple of things to you. But before we go, where can people find you? So social media, YouTube, wherever, where can people find you?
Yeah, so in hindsight, using my name probably wasn't the best idea because it's not easy to spell. But my YouTube channel and Twitter are just Jerry and then T-E-I-X-E-I-R-A, and I'll come up. Or bodyweightstrength.fit. I do have a website. I'm redoing it. I'm going to have because Twitter's not the best for organizing content, I'm always going to be active on Twitter because I just like the community. But I have a message board that's going to be on the web. Nice. It's already finished. I just have to push it live. But I have a message board organized by topic. So that way people can...
Awesome.
That way people can talk about specific, and it's mostly that message board is mostly body weight strength. So for people that want answers with regards to how I train, and that way I can help them in that regard. But there's like a low carb and a diet section and stuff like that. But I will have a board on there. So you can go to bodyweightstrength.fit, and that has links to my YouTube and Twitter and all that kind of stuff.
Awesome. Well, Jerry, listen, man, it has been a pleasure. I'm glad I got to talk to you. Excuse me. Thanks for coming on. Everybody, thank you for listening. Jerry, thank you so much. Hang on tight, buddy. I'll talk to you in a second. Thank you, everybody.
Yep.